Hello, everyone. It is great to be here one more time today. My name is Gary Fowler. And today on GSD Presents Top Global Stars, we're going to talk about some incredible thing with an incredible founder, Elizabeth Lawler. So today we're going to be talking about risks. We're going to be talking about reducing human risk, AI, cybersecurity, DevOps, and coaching founders in innovation. So with that, I'd like to go down through and introduce. We're joined by an extraordinary leader whose career spans software engineering, cybersecurity, developer tools, data science, and successful startup exits. Dr. Elizabeth Lawler is a serial tech founder, a scientist, and a product visionary. She began her journey as a programmer, moving into healthcare data leadership as a chief data officer at Generation Health, later acquired by CVS. And then went on to found Conjure, one of the earliest DevSecOps platforms, which was ultimately acquired by CyberArk. She didn't stop there. Elizabeth went on to co-found AppMap, an innovative developer observability. Oh, I'm losing those words. A surveillability platform trusted by hundreds and thousands of developers inside their code editors, helping teams build faster, debug smarter, and ship better software. Beyond building world-class tools, she's an active angel investor and a guiding voice for entrepreneurs navigating the chaos of innovation in everyday life. She embodies what it means to innovate at the intersection of data, security, and developer experience. And today, we get to learn exactly how she's shaping the future of software development. With that, I'd like to bring Elizabeth on board. Hi, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much, Gary, for having me on your show. I'm really delighted to be here.
So, you know, you've gone down through and you've taken this journey. You've built several successful companies, DevSecOps,
Observability. It's a catch-all phrase.
No, I got to have another drink of water here. But this and developer tooling. What's the through line? What problem have you been chasing your whole career? How did it start? You know, how do you go from epidemiology, seriously, to data science? You know, I also have a degree in statistics, so I know a little bit about it. But how do you go down through and do that? And why did you decide to take that journey?
Oh, thank you for asking that question. It has been a very interesting career. I think, you know, I studied epidemiology and biostatistics when it was the advent of starting to use electronic medical record data to solve all kinds of problems. And I was both on the IT infrastructure side, trying to build systems to be able to manipulate really large data, and also on the consumer side, trying to figure out how you can use systems to better inform decision making. And so I think the through line for my entire journey is how can we use, consume information, data in a way that helps us make better decisions and be more safe and be more secure. And, you know, I think it's been an interesting journey of thinking about how to apply that same sort of investigational skill set to solving problems for developers and cybersecurity professionals and DevOps professionals. And now in the advent of AI for folks who are using and consuming AI's coding assistants.
So, you know, AppMap takes a radically new approach by embedding observability directly in, boy, we like that word, in the developer's editor. What inspired the shift away from traditional tools?
Yeah, so, you know, I think that this is such an interesting explosion of the adoption of AI coding assistants across the ecosystem. But there's always been sort of one kind of key problem that developers experience whenever there's a problem in a production system, which is that the observability data, which come from production systems, are typically resonant with IT professionals or DevOps professionals. And mapping that information, which is often at a network level, down to the code that you actually have to go and change is really challenging. And you may not have the depth of insights that you need off of the tools that you would otherwise be using in production because it's expensive to instrument everything all the way down, right? It's too technically demanding to keep perfect view of every production system, and it's also very expensive from a latency and data collection standpoint. So you get what you need to try and do your best, but when it's you hand off a complex problem to a developer, you're then basically handing it off to the mental model that they have of how the code works when it runs. So what we decided, create was basically a system where developers don't have to actually do any extra work, can get a complete picture of how their application works when it runs, but outside of that production environment in their code editor. So anytime they're making a debug, they're trying to do debugging or trying to make a proactive code change to resolve an issue, they can actually see what that means from a systems perspective when they go to commit that code. And that's something you never see as a developer, right? You never get to see the working system drawn out in maps and diagrams, et cetera, before you ever ship your code. And so that actually creates a really wonderful feedback loop of how to kind of develop a more constructive process around some of these complex issues that usually don't manifest until later in the software delivery lifecycle. And when you add AI to that, now you have really powerful tools that can help you make really informed code changes, write wonderful test cases that will instrument and evaluate the code changes as well. So having that data there and having better prompts allows developers to get like a whole new information source other than the code base to inform their AI coding assistant as well.
Now, how do you think, you know, we look at it, right? The tools out there are dramatically shifting. In fact, I remember in 2016, I started one of those first generative AI company, pre-transformer models, and sold it already. But, you know, this is changing everything we do in our lives, Elizabeth, everything. Think about epidemiology, right? The tools that are out there today, you can have superpowers to be able to solve some of the most complex problems. And you don't, you know, I built a cancer vaccine about a year ago for my dog that had stage 4 cancer at a molecular level. And I'm not, you know, I'm not a scientist. I'm just a poor country boy. But I built a vaccine, and then I had stage 3 kidney disease. And I put it on myself, and it said if I used mesenchymal stem cells and had a full body stem cell replacement, so I had 100 million stem cells put in my body from an umbilical cord, and my stage 3 kidney disease is gone. I don't have it anymore.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and these frontier sciences, you know, and it's all about, you know, understanding the data. So when you found, you know, so you founded Conjure, DevSecOps wasn't even a mainstream term. How do you identify markets before they exist, and what really pushes you forward?
You know, I think that's both been a blessing and a curse for my career, which is that I do tend to see markets early in their development, and I follow trends. I'm always deeply interested in edge research, whether it's papers that are being published out of universities, because I live in the Boston area and I get the benefit of being exposed to some of the leading thinkers in AI and, you know, cybersecurity and cryptography and, you know, all of those types of wonderful disciplines. And then as well as, you know, just kind of keeping an eye on what the market trends. I'm an early adopter of everything too. I think I tweeted that code was going to be writing code in 2021, which was like far earlier than people were actually, you know, really using code as mainstream. AI is a mainstream coding assistant, which came on a couple of years later. I think by 2023, it was pretty much
your virtual crazy. Back in 2018.
Yeah,
so
wow.
I was Eva, YVA, right, .ai. And I started back then with my partner, David Yang, and we were talking about this thing, and people said, this is crazy. This is not going to happen, you know, for a long time. But now, think about in your world, Elizabeth, you got about 300,000 items in your personal cloud. The entire web in 1996 was 257,000 websites. You have more information in your personal cloud than the entire web. The problem with Elizabeth's world is following the same trajectory as the World Wide Web. It's doubling every year. And, you know, and as smart as we are, right, how many times the last 2 weeks somebody said, Elizabeth, I sent you an email. Did you get it? Where did you send it? I sent it to one of your 7. Where did you send it? 3 days ago. Will you send it again? You don't even look anymore. It's crazy. I don't either, because we have obesity. The infobesity problem is killing us. And the people that master these tools, like I'm using, in fact, right now, I have 14 large language models working as a team, asking, coming up with, listening to what we're saying and looking at your background. And it can do very complex questions, right? I don't do it for my audience. I did it yesterday and it was so far over the top that people didn't get it. But it's these tools give us superpowers, and we need to harness them, whether it's app map to visualize code execution, or it's to get down through and understand, my dog had stage 4 kidney disease, and, you know, we solved it, right? So using these tools to help us are going to
definitely, you know, and if there's like archaeological layers of your data, right? Like all of the information of your life lives in all of these different your eras or archaeologies of your personal data footprint. And that is really going to be the challenge I think that everyone's going to have going forward, is like, how do you synthesize them, figure out, you know, is it recency? Is it relevance? How do we figure out what we're going to emphasize with these? Because I can imagine that you've probably done a lot to sort of, I would say, beat the training out of your AIs.
The stuff that we're working on right now is beyond, it's actually, I have a development company. We put a few million dollars into it, building things. And these frontier models are really cool. Here's another thing. I don't know, I ask you about this. So we say that if you parent the AI, and then what I did is I took a Skinnerian operant conditioning approach, combined it, tokenized and combined it with Carl Rogers' client-centered therapy, unconditional love, and I created something very similar to what my grandmother was, right? So it loves you with empathy and compassion no matter what. And I built the model based, I'm a clinical psychologist too, right? And I built the model as to be able to go down through and love you, because, you know, some of these models don't have empathy and compassion. They're very pragmatic models.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually extraordinary, because, you know, it really shows what the power, like sort of the power of the linguistic training of these base models, and, you know, fine-tuned models can really be. And that I think is both, it's an aspect of their training, which is really powerful. Now, one of the things that we did was we partnered with model creators to do, we'll say like behavioral enhancement of the training sets, because some of the information beyond the linguistic or beyond the data, the sort of written or numeric or data set data that you might be providing these models is sort of outside of the scope of, it's like I would say, like, have these models been trained on the movies of behavior, or have they been trained on the script of behavior, right? The script of a movie. And they've been mostly trained on the scripts of movies and not on the, you know, actual play of the movie itself. And I think that that's really where these models might be going in the future, which is to start to predict more and more behavior in a real-time way. And then, you know, that's one of the things that people have been striving for in all sorts of forms, whether it's self-driving cars or, you know, what have you. But I think behavioral prediction, behavioral analysis in like real world scenarios, whether they're IT systems or physical systems or, you know, human systems, would be such a cool thing to think about from like a, you know, sort of a where's the edge and frontier perspective.
Yeah, I know, I agree with you. And, you know, when I did my research on the stem cells, and within 3 weeks, I actually had the stem cells put in, because I used the same model to go down through and in on myself. And I had mesenchymal stem cells from an umbilical cord put in live. So 3 hours after the woman delivered, I had the umbilical cords. And then I did it again. I'm one of 700 people that's ever done it twice on the planet. And what I found, I mean, it takes you back. So biologically, I'm 22 years younger. I'm almost 70 now. And it's like the Benjamin Button effect. It's unbelievable.
And did it impact other aspects of your health?
Yeah, I mean, so all the wrinkles went out of my face, all my blood sugars and all this stuff came in line. Cognitively, I went up about 20%. I didn't bench it before I went in because I didn't think about it. I had sciatic in my back that I never thought I would get rid of. It's completely gone in my neck and back. And what happened is I saw people with Parkinson's, dementia. I saw people with ALS come in there and walk again and talk. I can never see anything like it.
But think about that. You build an entire research system for a user of one.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, that's what AI gives you in terms of power, right? You can build a complete application or research and development platform or whatever for one person, for one end user, which is just,
if you know how to use it.
If you know how to use it, which is a phenomenal. It's a phenomenal R&D experiment we are all a part of, right? We're all contributing to the improvement of the next generation and future generations of both the workflow and the models, the ability for reasoning, et cetera. So, I mean, I think that's fantastic. I think what you have that also adds to the value of the platform, which I think people are coming up the learning curve to experience, is discrimination and taste, right? Like, you knew what you wanted, you knew how to build it, you knew what the levers were to get valuable responses back. And I think the general population is still on a very steep learning curve, but when we get there, either through better interface or through better models or what have you, I think there are people who are going to find real power, a lot more real power in this than we're getting now.
Unbelievable. I go down through, I had one of the top guys from Harvard that had been at Harvard under Avi Loeb, the 3AI Atlas, come in, and we were in some deep discussions about some interesting, very interesting things. And then, you know, I started to probe, like, trans-dimensional travel and traveling through wormholes, that at a very scientific level, like really, really diving into it. And I was surprised the kind of stuff that you can put together that probably not a lot of other people have ever done by just taking all this data and figuring things out. Elizabeth, I had a problem with my sports car, right? And the mechanic couldn't figure it out. Very, very, you know, well-known mechanics, 40 years worth of experience, that kind of guy. So I took the car and I took a picture of the engine light that went on and the code that came in. And it said, try this, Gary, go into the engine and take a picture of this part, right? And I took a picture of the part and it said, the part's bad. It needs to be replaced. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe that it told me exactly how to fix this thing. And it was like, I just did it to check it out, right? I had no idea that it would do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the ultimate way to, I mean, think about how much time that would have taken you otherwise. Like, it is, AI can be a time machine. Like, you were talking about wormholes and interstellar travel. I mean, it actually can be a time machine in the sense that it's doing things for you that are taking tremendous amounts of load off your plate or time wasting or what have you. Curious what kind of sports car you have, though, because I got
several of them out there. I built three Porsches. So I took them completely apart, you know, engine and transmission, all that stuff. And I put it back together and I took one of them and I turned it into a racing Porsche. And just to see if I could do it. And it was really hard. Let me tell you, it's easy to take them apart, but it's really hard to put them back together. So you don't realize how hard these little screws and, you know, torque wrenches and all this stuff. But what I understood is that these powers are so profound because I don't know about you, but I ask it questions that before I knew I would never get the answers for. Like how many planets in the Milky Way galaxy, right? 100 billion, 8 billion Earth-like planets, 2.8 trillion estimated galaxies in the universe, right? I never knew that. Then this thing with these extraterrestrials and Marco Rubio and all this stuff, analyzing all the data worldwide. I did it, right? I just was curious. And I was like, oh my God, this is profound on steroids, you know?
Yeah, and people feed it weird stuff like those, you know, ancient manuscripts of the Werner manuscript or whatever. People couldn't figure it out and they like fed it to AI and AI like decoded it and was able to explain what it was. Like, you know, those types of challenges that humans have had. I mean, AI is just so well suited to that kind of reasoning and analysis.
It's change everything. You know, it's opening us up because it teaches us, right? People say you're going to get dumb. I don't think so, because the questions you want to answer can be answered, like the cancer vaccine, like my stem cells and all kinds of other stuff. You change everything, actually.
And it's interesting because I think the younger, you know, just like where we have had many different eras of technology and there's, you know, sort of digital natives versus people who were kind of first generation internet people, and then there'll be the kids that grow up with AI as a constant, right? I think they'll probably be able to answer and ask more expansive questions because they'll have a more intuitive sense of how to work with it. Because the learning curve for them will be part of their education rather than, you know, sort of bolted on to preconceived notions. And you see that like with a lot of people now, they use AI in a very linear way. But what you're talking about is using AI in a parallel processing way, which is much more powerful in many regards.
You know, I was surprised about some of the things that you can, like the stem cell situation. I'm going to have 7 full body stem cells. I'll be number one in the world when I'm down through this process. You know, I call it the Benjamin Button effect because it really does change things. And, you know, I asked it profound questions like, you know, if somebody told you that you could live another 10 years and quality of life, how much would it be worth? And I put it in there like these philosophical questions. You know, and the thing is, ask anybody, what's it worth? Everything you have. Right. Everything you have.
And it's always interesting when you have humanistic answers like that, which come back from it. Because, you know, if you asked to Google, you could have gotten, just because of my background in healthcare research, used to be an insurance value on people's 1 year of life. But that's not the right answer, right? The right answer is what you said.
Well, but that's, you know, the thing is, it's really interesting because when you go down through these models and you start to look at it, and you start to, like for myself, right, with cerebroplasmin, peptides, and NAD, and stem cells and all this, I mean, I literally feel, you know, 20, I feel 22 years, and I am 22 years younger, right? So it changes everything. Everything, all the wrinkles went out of my face. It was crazy, actually. You know, and what happens is you get a new outlook on life because you have a very fresh approach to life like you do as a kid. You know, when you were wondrous about the butterfly and how they fly and how the caterpillar turns into a butterfly, you start to get those same kind of feelings again.
It's true. And it is a playground for people who have those types of ideas and notions. And you know, it's like I was saying, it's not even a linear process. You can actually have debates amongst them. You know, you mentioned you have many different AIs running, 14 different AIs running right now. And it's like you're trying to synthesize and create tension in the system to create the best possible answer set or the most well thought out, well reasoned answer set. And you can do that without any extra effort and barely any cost. I mean, it's just like all of that is so extraordinary.
Well, yeah, I agree. And, you know, yet at the same time, people are afraid of it. You know, and I tell them, I said, you know, you're going to be a dinosaur. And you know what happened to the dinosaurs? Nothing good.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so
even just getting people comfortable with scratching the surface of, hey, are you going on a vacation? Let it make your budget for you. You know, you can go to Gemini right now, pop in. Hey, I want to go to Miami for a week with my friends. Give me a budget, give me some hotel options, give me everything. It will be your personal assistant. It's happy to do that, and it'll calendar the whole thing for you. But people aren't even like doing the basics yet.
Well, one of the things we did is we took the AI and I said, what if we take it and turn it into a personal concierge on steroids? And I said, if I'm flying to Boston and it knows I like Delta, it knows I like the right-hand side of the plane in first class, it knows the kind of food that I want. It knows once I land that I want to play paddleball. It knows that, you know, it's the summer, I want to go up to Gloucester and get some lobsters and lobster bakes and that kind of thing. It knows like everything. It knows my friends that happen to be in the city at the same time as me. And it knows that we want to go to have sushi, and it knows which restaurant to pick out. It's unbelievable. We actually built the system. It exists, actually.
That's fantastic. And things, so that's all just the observable universe, right? We're giving your previous analogy. And so behind the walled gardens of government, enterprise, everything is the non-observable universe, which has more information than we can even see.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, I think it's phenomenal what could be potentially exposed for the benefit of humanity.
It's going to change everything, right? It's going to change. And I'm doing, you know, I'm spending 4 to 6 hours a day with it. Playing with it on different things. And here's the thing, like I said, whenever I have a question now, Olympus, I don't think about it. I just ask it the questions. I want to know the answer. And by the way, once you do that, your neurons and synapses change because they're being fed. You're not like thinking about something for 10 years, what about this, and then doing it. You're doing it, actually. You're asking the question. I wanted to know about how many planets in the Milky Way galaxy. Very interesting for me, right?
Yeah. And that's, you know, you're to your point, you're exercising your brain. You're not just consuming. And so, you know, that in and of itself, even if you were just to demote the experience to entertainment, there's more nutrition in it than watching like TikTok.
Good stuff. Although I like watching Anatoly, the weightlifting guy. I don't know if you understand. This guy comes in, he's so great. He comes in and says, oh, you must be very strong. And the guy's really skinny, but he's like a world champion power lifter. But he does right? And he comes in and says, I have to dust. And he goes around and dusts the barbells. And he said, how much weight is on here? They said 450 pounds. Oh, that's a lot of weight. Let me just clean up around here. And he goes in, do you mind if I just move it for a second? And the guy's laughing. He picks it up. he lifts the stuff up. And honestly, I get so happy watching these expressions on these people's faces. These guys looks like, you know, they're gym rats, right? They're big and all that. They said, how did you do that?
That's awesome.
Yeah, but, you know, those kind of things, the fun side of it, right? And kind of taking you on your, you know, it's almost like an existential dream. You go out and just float and watch these stupid things sometimes.
Like you've gained the time back to watch Anatoly because you use AI, right? Like there's a whole suite of things you're not doing with your time because you're busy, you're an entrepreneur, you're an inventor. And it's just like, you know, the thing is that by adopting that superpower that you have, you're able to go decide how you're going to use your time, which is why we're all here, right? We want to decide how we're going to use our time.
Barry said, you know, the crocodile time in Peter Pan, right? And so time's the thing that's always going away. So we have less time now than we did 15 minutes ago, right? And so wisely enjoy our lives. And, you know, the one thing I put in my model, I said, what's the most important thing in life? And they said, happiness. It said happiness. It came back to me. So all my large language models came back in happiness. Whatever happiness is exactly what it said to me.
Well, think about it. You know, if you've offloaded, you know, whether it's your digital concierge or all the research you did to create your stem cell program or whatever, that is all time that you got to spend with family, friends, making connections with other people. I mean, it's really, it gives you the opportunity to rebalance your personal time portfolio in ways that are super meaningful.
Yeah, exactly. No, I agree with you. So I got a question for you. So going down through it, you know, one of the things we started using quantum computers, right? So I'm working with, and the quantum computers are like 10,000 times faster than the fastest. It will 100 million times faster. What would take 10,000 years taking us 200 seconds now. So when we're at that order of magnitude fast, like for drug discovery and all that, and then I ran it through the model and I said, well, how fast can we crack Bitcoin, right? And it said, maybe next year. Like seriously, with quantum computers. And I was just, it was interesting. How do you think, when you're going down through it, right, security is going to be a big issue because we've got these quantum computers that can crack a lot of stuff really, really. Yeah. How important is it going to be able to develop these hyper secure systems that help us to be able to fix these issues before they're a problem? You know what I mean?
That's like, yeah, I hosted a panel recently on AI and cybersecurity here in Boston. And we were actually talking about this exact issue, which is that the standards for quantum cryptography are coming faster. I think 2027 is when people are going to start, NIST and others are going to start saying that quantum cryptography standards need to start being part of mandates. And that, you know, in so many ways, cryptography included, is the kind of like fortress approach to cybersecurity, as opposed to the avoid, misdirect, detect approach. And I think that hopefully quantum computing will also give us a lot of benefit in that regard too. You know, as opposed to just thinking about defending the perimeter and defending the information from a static position. I think that's one of the things when you have kind of infinite computing resources, you can start to think about doing in practice, which isn't really, it isn't very common having sort of morphing, you know, application networks just to avoid being, you know, avoid a penetrating risk. But I think it's coming because if you have infinite resources and infinite ability to scale and infinite and a watcher who's never tires, this isn't a human, you know, you can do some really neat things. That was something that we used to think a lot about when I was at Conjure, at a much more rudimentary level, which was having code do dynamic application deployments in order to avoid basically malicious intent. But like, I think it's something that, you know, everyone's going to start thinking a lot more about, which is, you know, we think a lot about linear processes, static environments, you know, none of that has to matter anymore, right? It's all infinitely scalable, infinite compute, infinite processing. Like, what are we going to do now, right? How will we reconstruct these systems? And I think that's such a fun thing to think about. And also, how do we reorganize ourselves, like, to take better advantage of these things? Again, like, whether, you know, whether you're like a person, and, you know, we often think about people being kind of full stack engineers and having to know all of the domain top to bottom, we can be much more of a network too, where we're adding our expertise in different domains at very specific points in time to make discriminating choices to help guide or nudge an AI along its path. But, like, it doesn't have to be sort of cradle to grave any one person's input anymore, you know?
No, I agree with you. And you know, how fast do you think these changes, you know, from your perspective, you look at AI, you're right in the heart of it. How much do you think will change in the next 3 years?
Like, you're on the bleeding edge. I was going to say, like, one of the problems that I have always had was just that, you know, I tend to be, we talked about this earlier, I tend to be out ahead of the trend. So I'll be like, oh, it's coming next year. And I think when I said code was new privileged user was 2013, and machine identity didn't lead the RSA conference until 2024. So it was 11 years early. But, you know, this scale of with which we're accelerating is just getting, it's faster and faster. I'm hoping that the deep research will continue on and that we won't all get to
start.
Economics of the businesses that are supporting some of this.
In front of us by 2050 at the double the food supply, we can't increase the amount of cows because 26% of the pollution's methane gas. So we need to go down through and we need plant-based protein, right? The average population around the world is 8.1 billion, going to 13 billion by the end of this century. You know, we got a lot of challenges in front of us. I just came back from Africa. I was in Africa last week in Nigeria, and there's a population, is the largest population in Africa is Nigeria, about 270 million. Growing way faster than the population of the U.S., especially under 30. So a lot of challenges. Listen, we should do a part two on this thing. We're coming up to, I just got a flag from my AI. It says that I'm coming up to the top of the show. And can you, closing thoughts, Olivis, and if you want us, what we can do is we want to stay on for a minute or actually jump on the phone. We could do that. And
that'd be great.
Closing thoughts, and how do people get a hold of you?
Oh, well, you can find me on LinkedIn. That's where I mostly hang out and talk about these topics, AI, cybersecurity risk, entrepreneurship in the space, future trends. And I think in terms of closing thoughts, I think you and I have had a wonderful conversation about the scale and immense opportunity. I think that your observation that fear is what's holding people back, rather than trusting themselves in their own judgment, I think is spot on. And so I think that's really one of the next little hurdles to get everyone over so we can start really exploring the network benefits of this wonderful new set of technologies.
No, I agree. And we got to do it sooner than later, right? So, you know, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining my show. And thanks to all of you for joining one more time. GST Presents Top Global Startups. My name is Gary Fowler, and I'm your host. Stay happy, stay safe, and stay healthy. And I'll be back to you again soon with another exciting edition. Thank you, everybody. And thank you, Elizabeth. And if you want to stay on,
let's reconnect. Yeah, I'll stay on. Yeah. Okay.
That was great, Elizabeth. I really appreciate you taking your time.